On this week's 51%, we spend time with cultural historian Dr. Rian Eisler, who examines where societies fall on the partnership domination scale.
As we give more value to the so-called soft or feminine, everyone benefits, including business.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Dr. Rian Eisler is an eminent social systems scientist, cultural historian, and attorney best known as the author of The Chalice and the Blade, Our History, Our Future. It inspired a generation of women and men to envision a truly egalitarian society by exploring the legacy of the peaceful, goddess-worshipping cultures from our prehistoric past. Her newest book, Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Brains, Lives, and Future, is co-authored with anthropologist Douglas Fry. Her pioneering work in human rights expanded the focus of international organizations to include the rights of women and children. She is co-founder of the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence and president of the Center for Partnership Studies in California. Eisler was born in Vienna, fled from the Nazis with her parents to Cuba, and later emigrated to the United States. She obtained degrees in sociology and law from the University of California, taught pioneering classes on women and the law at UCLA, and now teaches in the Graduate Transformative Leadership Program at the California Institute of Integral Studies. She also is an international consultant to businesses and governments on the application of the partnership model introduced in her work. She's received many honors and is included in the award-winning book Great Peacemakers as one of 20 leaders for world peace, along with Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. I spoke with Eisler about her work, in which there is a theme.
What's good for women is good for the world. And I have empirical evidence based on my research of this. For example, back in 1995, the Center for Partnership Studies, which is the organization that's really sort of an action arm for my work, we have webinars and online courses, etc. We did a study called Women, Men, and the Global Quality of Life, comparing statistical data from 89 nations. And what our result was, foreshadowing much that we are learning today, is basically that the status of women is a powerful predictor of general quality of life of a nation.
So let's take that a step or two further. What is the indication now?
Well, the Global Gender Gap reports, the nations, which are usually the Northern European nations, Sweden, Finland, Norway, that are regularly show that they have the lowest gender gap by far, are also the nations that appear regularly in the top tiers of the World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Reports. So in terms of economic health, if you will, these nations, which have a higher status of women, about 50% of the national legislature is female, not coincidentally have more caring policies. And this is very interesting because at the beginning of the 20th century, these nations were so poor there were famines. You know, whole U.S. states, Minnesota, right, got populated by people fleeing. As the status of women rises, so also does the value given to stereotypically feminine activities, such as caring for people, keeping a clean and healthy home environment, which of course transfers and translates into keeping a healthy planetary environment. So not coincidentally, these nations pioneered caring policies, universal health care, very generous paid parental leave for both mothers and fathers in families where there is a mother and a father present, high quality and very accessible early childhood education, parenting education. And because they invested in their human capital, lo and behold, they have, because they're not socialists, they have a very healthy market economy, but they also have caring government policies. Because as the status of women rises, not only women, but also men find it possible to embrace more stereotypically feminine activities and values.
Where do you think, having said that, where is the U.S. at the moment on that kind of caring economy scale? I certainly not as advanced as some of the other countries you mentioned, but you know, when you look at the nation as a whole, where are we?
We're not doing well at all. What we at the Center for Partnership Studies developed are what we call social wealth economic indicators. And they show that not coincidentally, the United States has the highest child poverty rates, the highest infant mortality rates, the highest maternal mortality rates of any developed or OECD nation. And guess what? We also invest less than half the OECD average in family support. That's a stunning bit of information, and it's not only devastating in human and certainly environmental terms, too, because we also invest much less than, for example, the Northern European nations are really way ahead of us in protecting our natural environment. But it is also economically disastrous for us as we enter the post-industrial knowledge service age. Economists keep telling us that the most important capital is what they like to call high-quality human capital, flexible people who can adapt to change, including rapid technological change, who can work in teams, etc. And we're not investing in that because we know from neuroscience, which really takes me to my newest book, that whether or not these capacities are developed largely hinges on the quality of care and education children receive in their very early years. We've got a real problem in this country.
Please talk more about your latest book and what led you to write it.
Well, my new book, Nurturing Our Humanity, combines my research of societies, human societies, cross-culturally and historically, research that identifies two underlying social configurations. The domination system and the partnership system is the other one, categories that really transcend right-left, religious-secular, Eastern-Western, Northern-Southern, because if you really think about it, there have been repressive, regressive societies in every one of those categories. We need, you know, what linguistic psychologists tell us, of course, and we have to pay attention to it, is that the categories, especially the social categories, provided by a language, channel our thinking. So if you look at society from this perspective, what you see is that, yes, in the United States, we are in the midst of a massive regression to the domination side of the social scale. But I started to say about this book, it combines my findings, and I can go into that a little more later, with, first of all, what we know today from neuroscience about how our brains develop in interaction with our environments. And yes, it shows that, well, the subtitle is of the book is how domination and partnership shape our brains, lives, and future. But it also combines it with something else, which are the work of my co-author, the anthropologist Douglas Frye, who is probably one of the world's experts on foraging societies, which is how we humans lived for millennia, debunking this mythology that of evolutionary imperatives. You know, we're all familiar with those, with those stories, right? Too bad, but, you know, evolutionary imperatives going way back to our early days of our species, they just drive us, right, to rape, to murder, absolute nonsense. Frye calls the foraging societies the original partnership societies.
Interesting. And please feel free to go more into this. This is a fascinating fascinating subject, and the way you look at it even more so, while, of course, troubling. But please go more into what you found, you know, as you're researching for this and writing and obviously co-authoring with Douglas Frye. What kind of made you say, oh my goodness, we're doomed if we don't do X, Y, or Z, or there's hope because if we do X, Y, and Z, things will be better?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked that, Alison, because my first books, including The Chalice and the Blade, which is the book I'm probably best known for, it's now in its 56th or 57th U.S. printing, and I think 27 foreign editions. And then I wrote Sacred Pleasure, looking at sexuality and spirituality from the perspective of how they differ in the context of partnership or domination-oriented societies. They were really trying to understand, how did we get here? What is there an alternative to this, you know, all of this misery, all of this violence, all of this injustice that we see all around us? And the answer was a resounding yes, and that alternative is deeply rooted in our past. So those books already foreshadow the work of Douglas Frye. But then more and more I started to write books well, what do we do to bring about the shift from domination to partnership? Because obviously in our prehistory there was what I call a 5,000-year domination detour, and we've been trying to dig out from that. So I wrote a book on economics called The Real Wealth of Nations, and introducing what I call a caring economics, or partnerism. And this last book, I have been working on it for 10 years because I was so struck by what we're learning from neuroscience. And then 3 years ago, I invited Doug to be my co-author. And this book really does end with four cornerstones. And yes, gender is one of the cornerstones. Childhood, gender, economics, but a new economics that goes beyond both capitalism and socialism, which really do not accord value to either caring for people or caring for nature. You know, for both Marx and Smith, that was just reproductive work. And we know how crazy that is, but they came, both capitalism and socialism came out of times that still oriented much more to the domination side. For example, a married woman could not sue for injuries negligently inflicted on her. Only her husband could for loss of her services, okay? I mean, we don't know our history because it is not taught. And it was, I'm going to be very nonlinear with you, but really, if you think about it, out of 1,600 years of so-called modern Western science, it was only 50 years ago that gender studies, women's studies, men's studies, queer studies even entered the university, and it's still they're still marginalized, right? And child development is still not taught as part of sociology, economics. It's sort of, again, marginalized, right? You know, we're going to look at how children develop, but without a context. What does it do not only to the individual child or to the individual family, but to society? And that really is one of the central themes of this book. And as I said, it ends with practical interventions grounded in decades of research.
Would you please offer one or two? I mean, I'm not trying to be simplistic, but without having, you know, hours-long conversations about it. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, we're just getting the idea, and it sounds so rudimentary, but we're just now getting the idea of interconnectedness of everything, that you just don't look at issues in isolation. You don't look at people in isolation. As you mentioned, there's context. Context is everything to me. And so I'm just wondering what, you know, what is the recommendation or what you see, you know, going forward for success, if you will, in getting a more egalitarian society?
Well, it's these four cornerstones, and you're quite right, Allison. My method is very heavily influenced, well, first of all, by systems analysis. And, you know, my first job before I went back to law school, I was as a social systems scientist at an offshoot of the Rand Corporation. And that was four decades ago, when really we are still taught about thinking in terms of just simple causes and effects. But living systems, well, interconnection, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That we have to think about. And we are not taught to do this. The universities are still so siloed, so fragmented, you know, one course here, one course there, rather than showing the connections. This is what nurturing our humanity does. And it proposes that, well, I'll start with sociology. Sociology needs to include, as do the domination and the partnership systems as social categories, particular attention to our primary human relations, which are childhood and gender relations, aren't they? Why? Because we know from neuroscience that what children first experience and observe really shapes nothing less than how their brains develop. I mean, that's basic, isn't it? There are partnership trends. I mean, for example, the American Psychological Association just recently, finally, stated, published, you know, a statement saying that spanking is not only ineffective as a method of teaching children, but that it is harmful. Well, I mean, of course, you know, people are socialized in domination systems that it's okay to use force to impose your will on others. That's what children observe in the so-called traditional family, which is a code for an authoritarian, rigidly male-dominated, highly punitive family, right? I mean,
yeah.
It's moral, isn't it, to use force to impose your will. And gender. Gender is fundamental. Because what do children really learn when you have a model of humanity in which difference, beginning with the fundamental difference in form between the male and female form, is equated with either superiority or inferiority, with either dominating or being dominated, with either being served or serving? They have a template, don't they, for in-group versus out-group thinking, whether it's based on race, religion, sexual orientation. So whether it's Shia against Sunni or Sunni against Shia or whites against blacks in the United States, it doesn't matter. It's not coincidental that whether it was for Hitler in Germany, you know, a Western secular society, whether it is for Khomeini in Iran or ISIS in the Middle East, a religious fundamentalist society, a top priority is always going back to this, quote, traditional family and the subordination of women.
You know, when I look at this country and you look at this domination structure in power at the highest level of power right now, does that set us back as a society? Or how is it working in partnership, not the kind of partnership you have in mind, but a lot of women and others kind of uprising, and there's a continual backlash that's not just a backlash to one event, but it's continual. The Me Too movement, March for Our Lives, Students Against Gun Violence. You know, there are just, it's continual, and now about racism. There's just so many groups, and it's every weekend there's something happening in a community somewhere to combat this domination, be it race, gender, or anything else. Is that a hopeful message?
Absolutely. You know, you remind me, years ago I received a letter from a young high school student, and she wrote, you know, I go to this progressive high school and we're always having a protest against something. And she wrote, I realize now that we're just protesting against one thing, domination systems in all their manifestations. But if, now this is the thing, for the last three centuries, four centuries, as the Industrial Revolution and you know, proceeded and destabilized, you know, all kinds of things, the nature of work, the nature of family, we've had one progressive social movement after another challenging traditions of domination. You know, whether it was the so-called rights of man movement, challenging the supposedly divinely ordained right of kings to rule, or the women's movement challenging the supposedly divinely ordained right of men to rule the children and women in the castles of their homes. You know, a military metaphor, or the, again, so-called divinely ordained right of a, quote, superior race to rule, quote, inferior ones, all the way to the environmental movement, challenging our once hallowed conquest of nature, which could do us in at this level of technological development. But the problem is that these movements have primarily tried to dismantle the top of the domination pyramid, you know, politics and economics as conventionally defined, and they have not paid sufficient attention to the foundations, childhood, gender. Do you see where I'm going here?
Absolutely.
And so where does it keeps rebuilding itself. Again, it's not coincidental that Hitler rose to power at a time when the German family was a domination family. That was the ideal norm. It's not coincidental that the ideal norm for ISIS is this rigidly male-dominated, authoritarian family, right? I mean, we have to connect the dots. That's what my work does. And I so want to get it to young people because it is really, look, cultures are human creations. We create them. And our brains develop in interaction with our environments, which for humans are primarily cultural, as mediated by social institutions from the family, education, religion, politics, economics. We can bring about change, but we have to understand that there are these four foundations that we have to pay attention to. And unfortunately, a lot of progressives still think of anything that affects the majority of humanity, women and children, as just women's and just children's issues. Got to change that.
So how regressive will we become as a society given our power structure now?
Well, we have a lot of work to do, and this is one of the reasons that I have focused so much on these four cornerstones and why we developed the social wealth economic indicators at the Center for Partnership Studies, because if we, look, we value what we measure and we measure what we value, and we have not been giving value to care work. Why is that so important? Because as we give more value to the so-called soft or feminine, everyone benefits, including business, okay? And that's what humans want. Humans want caring connections. But, you know, yes, I don't think that we need to despair. On the other hand, what's happening is very serious, especially because of our technologies and especially with global warming and, well, you know, and climate change. I mean, it is very, very serious. And denial, you know, one of Nurturing Our Humanity uses a lot of studies from neuroscience. And we know, for example, from one of the studies cited in the book, that people who grow up in these very rigid domination families, they tend to really actually have a brain, a section of the brain that responds to change, has a terrible time doing it. You know, they, in fact, this was presaged already by the experiments of a psychologist called Else Frankel Brunswick, and she found that people who score high on the F for fascist scale were people who came from these kinds of families, and she'd show them the picture of a dog that slowly became a cat, you know, and they couldn't see the cat for I mean, it just, it was almost as if the voice of authority was, this is a dog, don't you dare change it.
That was Dr. Rhian Eisler. Her latest book is Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Brains, Lives, and Future. It is co-authored with anthropologist Douglas Fry and published by Oxford University Press. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1591.